TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dangers from Drugs Manufactured Overseas, with Catherine Eban, author of Bottle of Lies, and Dr. Harry Lever. In the first of this two-part program, we heard that nearly 80% of the active ingredients of all brand name and generic drugs, as well as almost all antibiotics in the U.S., are made outside of the country without any effective oversight, mostly in China and India. There's growing evidence that many of these drugs can be ineffective or contain toxic ingredients. Catherine Eban's book, Bottle of Lies, is the detective story, now in the hands of medical staff, FDA administrators, and all who fight for disclosure and safer medicine. This program opens with Catherine Eban's story of Ranbaxy. Ken Ford is with the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition.
You write quite a bit in the book about Ranbaxy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be India's largest generic drug company. You know, they seemed, according to your book, to have a business plan or business model comprised substantially of fraud and deceit.
Mm-hmm. I think the best way to tell the Ranbaxy story is through the prism of a new research and development director who came on in 2004, Dr. Raj Kumar. And he came from GlaxoSmithKline. He was recruited, and he gets to Ranbaxy, and he gets to the corporate headquarters in Gurgaon, and he begins to suspect that something is wrong and that there may be a problems with the company's data, and that maybe some of the data that they've submitted to regulators is not accurate. So he taps this young engineer named Dinesh Thakur to investigate every drug application that the company has filed with regulators around the world, hundreds of drug applications, go back to the underlying raw data that supported those applications and figure out if the data is real or fake. So Thakur delves into this, and he realizes that almost all the data is fake, and in a remarkable way. So, for example, the company was using brand-name drugs and testing those in lieu of its own generics and submitting that data to regulators as though it were data from their own medicine. They're substituting unapproved ingredients that are of lower purity. They're inventing documents from whole cloth, like standard operating procedures, and they're literally, to make those documents look old, steaming them in a sauna-like room. You know, as you said, fraud is their business model, and dozens of people in the company are in on it, right? There's trails of emails. They even are smuggling in brand-name samples in suitcases that they buy at Walmart. They have them lined up in satellite offices around the world. They force their employees to smuggle in these brand name samples into India, turn them into drug mules so that they can run data off of them to submit to regulators. So what happens is the research and development director submits Dinesh's findings to the board of directors, and they basically say, let's destroy this evidence and the computer on which it was aggregated. They decide to cover it up. And basically, in the events that follow, Dinesh Thakur becomes a whistleblower who brings this evidence to the FDA and ultimately brings the company down.
The book contained a nice story about how he became a whistleblower. Mm-hmm. This had to be a tough decision for him.
Well, it certainly was. And, you know, the life expectancy for whistleblowers in India is not very long. You know, they're not legally protected. There is a long trail of whistleblowers being assassinated. But he literally could not sleep at night when he thought about the company's drugs. And he was particularly troubled by the HIV drugs for Africa, and he knew they were no good. In fact, they were worse than other drugs the company was making. He started reaching out to regulators around the world. You know, he reached out to Anvisa in Brazil. He reached out to European regulators. He reached out to the FDA, and he did it all pretending that he was a lowly bench scientist, not a corporate executive. So he used broken English. And the emails he was sending were not really authoritative enough to get anybody to pay attention. So he finally sends this email to the FDA commissioner at the time, Lester Crawford, and he just drops the broken English, pulls no punches, says, here's what's going on, and you've got to put a stop to this crime. And that's how he gets in dialogue with the FDA.
Hmm. So what eventually happened to Rambaxi?
So Rambaxi finally, after an 8-year investigation by the FDA, pleads guilty to 7 felonies for faking data. In the process, it had been purchased by a Japanese company, Daiichi Sankyo, and then after its guilty plea, it gets purchased by another Indian company, it gets absorbed. So Rambaxi, you know, which was a source of national pride in India, it was the largest drug company, one of the first successful multinationals. Basically, Rambaxi ceased to exist.
So despite the really amazing work that Peter Baker did and you described in the book, I understand that he ended up leaving the FDA. Why is that? What motivated him to leave?
Well, you know, you would think if you had this remarkable investigator who had honed this method for finding fraud, that you would want every investigator at your agency trained in that method, right? So you could really know what was going on in these plants.
But that's actually the last guy that they'd want to have trained. You're familiar with any aspect of this.
Yeah.
The government.
That's right. Well, that's exactly right. You know, so that didn't happen. He made a proposal to the FDA to let him train his colleagues, and they essentially sidelined him. They pulled him off of investigations, and he ended up quitting.
Essentially, he was a troublemaker from their perspective.
Well, he certainly knew how to find trouble in manufacturing plants. The problem, you know, the problem is this. You have investigators finding fraud in manufacturing plants and documenting it. Then you, as an agency, have to do something about it. Right? Now you know there's fraud in this plant. You know the data is fake. You know, therefore, that the drugs aren't safe. So what are you going to do about it? You have to take action. And that action ends up reducing the number of drugs you're approving, reducing the pipeline of generic drugs that are available, reducing the numbers that you show to Congress to prove, hey, we got this. It's all good. And so the politics of this all seem to militate against disclosure of these problems.
Absolutely. And one can see how that would happen.
So because Baker and other FDA investigators found so much deception and fraud in China and India, it seems as if we need better and stronger regulations in the FDA to protect American consumers. So do you have a sense of what's going on here in the U.S. when it comes to the FDA?
So I would say right now, behind the scenes, there is a struggle over this. Congress is looking into this. They've held now several hearings. They are mining the findings that are in Bottle of Lies. And the FDA's position is that maybe things aren't perfect, but we've essentially got this. We have a reliable system for inspecting drugs and keeping Americans safe. And, you know, the question is, like, which version of this reality is going to win out here? Because pressure is building for the FDA to make real changes to its foreign inspection program. There are now millions of Americans who were taking blood pressure medicine, Valsartan, Losartan, Irbesartan, that came from active ingredient overseas, and it turned out that that active ingredient contained carcinogens. And those drugs have been recalled. And, you know, understandably, people are upset. So what is the public health response going to be? And that is not clear yet.
Does this become an argument for us in the United States and Canada and similar places to start producing more of our own drugs as opposed to having them produced in places like China and India?
It is absolutely an argument for that. No drug is improved in safety by having it manufactured 7,000 miles away from FDA headquarters. It is obviously the safer route to manufacture your own drugs so that we're not dependent on supply chains that have been interrupted by coronavirus and you're not risking bad inspection practices when plants are alerted to the fact that you're coming. Yeah, there's every argument in the world for making our own drugs.
And I suspect that a lot of our listeners are wondering how they can find out where their generic drugs are being manufactured. On your website, to which we will link in the show notes, you've created a resource that's titled A Guide to Investigating Your Own Drugs. Can you give us a little bit of a summary of that guide?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, after the book came out, I was literally flooded with emails from patients asking that very thing. How can they know where their drugs are made? The short answer, unfortunately, is they can't know for sure, because that information is not being made available to the public, right? You can know who the manufacturer is, but that doesn't necessarily tell you the plant in which it was made. Mm-hmm. However, there are things you can know. And so what I did is I tried to get that information into the hands of readers in a series of steps, you know, to first look and find out who the manufacturer is. Remarkably, that's something most of us don't do, right? We just assume that what the FDA has told us is true, that these drugs are interchangeable with one another, they're all bioequivalent, so mostly we don't even look. So the first step is to look and figure that out. Then you can do a little research about that company. Has it had warning letters or import alerts? You know, has it had data integrity problems? What has the FDA found in its plants? If you feel you want to switch, I also provide a number of resources there, ways to figure out what other manufacturers are making this drug? Is there an authorized generic version of this drug? So basically trying to put as many tools as possible into the hands of readers. Now, that said, there aren't yet enough tools, and that's where changes, in my view, really need to be made. But these are, you know, first steps that patients can take.
Valuable ones as well.
Absolutely. I remember listening to an interview that you did and thought, wouldn't it be nice if there were a pharmacy chain that tested every drug that they dispensed to ensure quality? And further on in the interview, I learned that there is such a mail order pharmacy. So can you tell us a little bit about Valisure?
Yeah. So, you know, as I was closing the book and getting it ready for publication, I did begin hearing a little more about this small pharmacy in New Haven called Valisure that has this really novel business model, which is they don't dispense drugs unless they've actually tested them in their lab. And it was this little pharmacy that found these high levels of a carcinogen called NDMA in Zantac. And Valisure's findings over Zantac have led to these worldwide recalls. But to me, the sort of the biggest importance of Valisure is twofold. It highlights the fact that the FDA is not actually systematically testing our drugs. It's reviewing company data. So now that we know that oftentimes the data is fake, how does that model help us, right? The FDA should be systematically testing these drugs. It shouldn't be left to one pharmacy in New Haven, Connecticut to police the world's drug supply, you know? So that is definitely one important point. The other one is that Valisure really provides a kind of model for the big pharmacy chains. What if a CVS or a Duane Reade suddenly stepped up and said, you know what, we're going to do this too. We're not going to dispense drugs that we don't test. This is possible to do. You know, I think maybe that is the direction that we're going here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, and it seems more likely to be efficacious than waiting for Congress to fix the problem or for the FDA to respond.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were recently in India to do some talks and book signings, but I understand that you were concerned about the reception that you were going to receive because their government had put out a statement saying it was going to take action against your book. That must have been pretty unnerving.
I have to say it was a little bit concerning to a couple of days before I was supposed to be off to India on a book tour, you know, seeing these articles appear in the Indian press that the Modi government is thinking about taking action. You know, I had already known from my colleagues in India that it's tough to be a journalist there right now. It's dangerous. So, you know, we were somewhat concerned about making this trip. For, you know, we contacted the State Department and the embassy, and I went with some trepidation. But to my surprise, what I encountered in India was so much gratitude from patients who have long suspected there's something wrong with their generic drugs. So, you know, the lesson for me in all of this is that patients want to know. readers want to know. They want more information. They're grateful for it, even if the information is not terrific news. So it was quite an experience to be there.
That's great. Yeah. What are you working on these days? You must have a new project in the hopper.
Well, you know, so Bottle of Lies continues to take up a lot of time.
I'm sure.
The paperback is coming out in May. But since the book came out, I have been contacted by so many whistleblowers that I've had to create an actual spreadsheet of whistleblowers. And yeah. So I'm sifting through information and documents and sort of figuring out what the next steps are.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Are you still in touch with Harry Lever at the Cleveland Clinic? We discussed him earlier.
I am. And he's continuing to be an amazing advocate for patients and an amazing advocate on this issue. So he's really outspoken. He's working on this. He's trying to get people's attention. So, you know, he contacts me a lot. We are in touch.
Wonderful. And what about another important character in your book, $4 Refill?
I talk to $4 Refill all the time, too.
That's good.
Well, Catherine, it's been fantastic having a chance to chat with you today. Thank you so much for coming on to SimTalk.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
That was the author of Bottle of Lies, Catherine Eban. She had a conversation with Ken Ford and Don Kernagis of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition. They spoke on March 12, 2020. Dr. Harry Lever is a cardiologist at Cleveland Clinic and a longtime and ongoing collaborator with Catherine Eban. On June 4, 2020, he spoke with Lisa Solberg about the safety and use of some generic drugs.
So, today we are going to be talking to Dr. Harry Lever from the Cleveland Clinic. We're going to talk about generic drugs. We're going to do a little history on that. So, can you tell us when generic drugs hit the market and kind of what the lay of the land was at that time and how things have changed?
Well, 1984, there was a law passed in Congress, the Hatch-Waxman Act. And what basically they were trying to get drugs on the market cheaper. They felt that if a drug had been name brand and they didn't have to be thoroughly studied like it was when the drug first appeared. So there was called an abbreviated drug application where they would only have to study about 25 normal volunteers to make sure that the blood levels were okay. And what they did was they said that the blood level had to fall between 80 and 125% of the blood level of the name brand drug. If you had that, that was enough to get the drug on the market. The problem was that for some drugs, it's a little wide. Some drugs have what we call narrow toxic to therapeutic ratios. That means the blood level has to be closer to the name brand drug, but that, at least that's what they started with. And for the most part, things were running reasonably well. The drugs were being made in this country. And then people began to realize that they could make them overseas even cheaper. And that's where we started running into some difficulties, particularly now they're coming from India and China. They're not all bad, but some of them don't work very well. And that's been a major problem. And I got interested in this problem on May the 25th of 2007. I was driving to work and listening to NPR, and there was a program on, it was about food and drugs coming from China. And at that time, I didn't have a clue that that was going on, and it was rather shocking when I listened to the program and realized that there were problems with this stuff coming from China. And I started doing Google searches, drugs China, and found that there were indeed a lot of drugs. And one of them was heparin, the blood thinner that we use in the hospital for heart surgery and for people that have blood clots and stuff like that. And we had realized that some people were having some difficulty with heparin. Their platelet count would fall, which does happen sometimes. It just can be an immunologic reaction, but we I I called our pharmacy when I saw that heparin was coming from China. I said, where are we getting our heparin from? And they said, oh, it's Baxter, a good American drug company. I said, are you sure? And they said, yeah. Indeed, what had happened, Baxter had gone to a company in Wisconsin, and they were a venture capital firm to have the drug made. So they thought they could have it done cheaper. Well, this firm, unbeknownst to Baxter, went to China to have it made. And they, at that time, there was a shortage of pigs in China. And that's where the heparin comes from, the small intestine of a pig. There was a disease in the pigs, and the Chinese realized they didn't have enough. And they found this strange anticoagulant that they mixed with the heparin called supersulfated chondroitin sulfate, because they had found in an article in it that was tested in test tubes that it seemed to thin the blood. Well, problem was they didn't know that it would cause a severe allergic reaction. There was an infectious disease doctor in St. Louis who had four kids who were on dialysis, and they suddenly got sick, and she reported it to the FDA, and the FDA took it to the CDC. And long story short, they found this chemical in there, and it took them about 5 months to find it. And it turned out that 100 people died from this heparin. So that raised a lot of concerns. And that's sort of how I got interested in it. And then I started looking at other drugs that were being made overseas, and some of them I found in my practice were causing trouble. One of them in particular was metoprolol succinate, which is we use for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patients. And I was starting to see people coming in, and they suddenly weren't doing well. And that's how I got really started with it.
So let's talk about name brand drugs versus generic. In the law that was passed in the 80s, there were parameters that were given for how equal these drugs needed to be. Right. They were never viewed to ever be 100% equivalent.
Right.
Can you tell us what those percentages are and why that's
important? That was between 80 and 125% of the blood level of the name brand. And one of the problems was that the generic drug companies were never given the exact formula for the name brand drug. And they sort of had to come up with their own formulas. And one of the problems was in the inactive ingredients, actually, that were mixed with the active ingredient. And the problem is that if the inactive ingredients are the things that cause it to be absorbed or not be absorbed. And that's where some of the problems, so they would tend to come up with their own formulas for that. One of the problems we started seeing was maybe batch to batch variation. You know, it wasn't each batch that they would make wasn't quite the same. So that's a whole other issue. But it mattered how diligent the company was. And the other problem was that in this country, the FDA routinely would go in and inspect plant every 2 years unannounced. Well, when they would go in overseas, they might give them 3 months notice. And so if they had a problem in the plant, they'd clean it up before the FDA got there. And that was a problem also, and continues to be.
So I want to take a deeper dive into, you know, what's happened since the Generic Drug Act kind of passed in the 80s, allowing them to be put to market. This 80 to 120 or 125% of the actual name brand drug was in a time where we didn't really have time release medications. There right. were no long actings. So right. can you explain how sensitive these time release molecules are in
the that was one of the problems, is that the generic drug, they would not be given the formula for them to make to know how to make it for sustained release. It wasn't quite as critical if you were taking a short-term drug that would, say, be there for 4 to 6 hours. But when you were taking something that was supposed to be there for almost 24 hours, it had to be made in the right way. But that formula did not have to be released to the generic drug companies. And so with metoprolol succinate, for instance, it's a very complicated formula to make to cause it to release slowly. And actually, they're little pebbles in the tablets, and then they have a special covering on them, and then the tablet itself has a special covering so that it would be released in a slow, steady way. That's where some of the problems have occurred, mainly where we're dealing with long-acting drugs. Although some of these shorter-acting drugs also have problems if they're not made in the way they should be. And one of the things that we have found is that the conditions in some of these plants overseas are not good. They're not clean. And then when the FDA can't get in there on a surprise visit, that's a big problem. And right now, with this COVID business, there are no inspections going on overseas because they didn't want to expose the inspectors to go into these places. So that's another problem.
So right now, we have no eyes on the ground, nobody watching the production of medication that will be given to millions upon millions of Americans and others.
That's right.
Nobody's really watching.
That's right.
So that's not good.
Nope.
That's not good. So we know the history. We know that some people are known to have died from poor quality drugs. And we know, I shared my story recently about my anti-rejection medication. They changed my manufacturer and told me it was an equivalent. And because I know to look for such things, after 3 weeks on the med, I went and got my blood levels tested and found out that I was below therapeutic level and I was at risk for rejecting my organ, my heart. And I changed my dosing and I got everything back in line and I went back into therapeutic range. So variability from manufacturer to manufacturer can be real. You metabolize one thing and not another or vice versa. You have quality issues that are still out there that we don't have a lot of control over right now in the world. And not to get political, but why are we offloading our manufacturing of something as important as our medications to places that we don't have eyes on the ground to make sure of the quality? So I think this is a major, major issue that people don't know about. And I think they should get a little bit more engaged in understanding where their drugs come from, how that process works, what the supply chain looks like, and how much control we actually have over it and don't.
That was an excerpt of a one-hour episode of Tales from the Heart, hosted by Lisa Solberg. She spoke with Dr. Harry Lever, cardiologist at Cleveland Clinic. The book Bottle of Lies by Catherine Eban inspired many of these discussions, and the investigative reporting, fact-finding, and reform movements. Check out Catherine Eban's website for her guide to investigating your own drugs, and more links to material on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.